ويغفر الله أكبر. الله أكبر الله أكبر.
The name of God, the beneficent, the merciful, the creator and sustainer of the universe. Peace and blessings upon your servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Ameen. I greet you with a greeting that is common in Islam, Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our ninth program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. We'll be continuing our discussion of the topic of production and productivity with an examination of Muslim contributions to the fields of medicine and geography. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining me on the program as usual Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Dr. Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Could I have you very quickly highlight and summarize the main points that we touched on in our eighth program last week?
Certainly. The eighth program focused mainly on Muslim contribution to the fields of mathematics and physics. In mathematics, we spoke about the introduction of the Arabic numerals and the concept of zero, which led to a revolution in mathematics. And we examined some particular fields, such as algebra, which was initiated by Al-Khwarizmi in the 9th century, and from his name came the term logarithm. A contribution to areas such as geometry and trigonometry, and we said that Muslims were the first to use sine and cosine. There were contributions in the fields of calculus and commercial arithmetics. In the area of physics, we spoke of Ibn al-Haytham's or al-Hazen's work in optics, which was the basis for the research in this area for several centuries and had far-reaching influence on Bacon and Kepler. And finally, we spoke briefly about the invention of the compass and also contribution to other areas such as the hydrostatics and hydraulics.
Mm-hmm. Well, now moving to today's topics, first of all, looking at the question of medicine, could you explain for us in what way the contributions to the field of medicine may be related to the to Islamic teachings?
Well, the interest of Muslims in the field of medicine is related to Islamic teachings in more than one way. First of all, it is related to the ethics of Islam, and that the human body is regarded as a trust in our hands given by God so that we can fulfill our trusteeship on earth. And as such, we have no right, according to Islamic ethics, to destroy that body. That's why we mentioned earlier in several series before that suicide is forbidden in Islam. We have no right to abuse that body that is given to us by God, whether by the prohibition, through prohibition of drinking, for example, alcoholics or harmful drugs, or prohibition of pork. Not only this, we find also that there are certain other preventative measures also that Islam taught, which have some bearing on medicine. This includes, for example, encouraging people to seek cure when they are sick, as we find narrated in Bukhari, Ahmad, Tirmidhi, and Abu Dawood. And the saying of the Prophet when he says that when the plague, which was a serious contagious disease, breaks out in one place, don't leave it and don't enter, which is the modern concept of quarantine, the health regulations to quarantine. Yeah. Also, the recommendation that the Prophet made to give attention to the body, when he says, to your body also there is a claim on you. Even in the simple rituals of Islam, if you will, if you use the term ritual, like the prayers, for example, you find that it's very much connected with personal hygiene and cleanliness, ablution, frequent bathing, encouragement of sport is part of it, because again the prayer includes movement of the body, fasting, we have discussed that also in the series on pillars of Islam, has also some beneficial benefits health-wise. So in more than one respect, you can say that Muslim interest in medicine is somewhat tied in with the overall outlook of Islam towards life, human body, and health care and protection.
Mm-hmm. Now, from your understanding of the history of Muslim contributions to medicine, when did the contribution to the field of medicine first begin?
Well, in a way, if you're taking the Muslim history in particular, you can say that even since the days of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, there has been an increasing interest in health, both preventative and remedial. In fact, there used to be doctors during his time called Al-Harith bin Kilda, and the Prophet used to recommend people who get sick to go and seek some cure. That is at the time when most people believed in miracle cures elsewhere. Even in the 8th century, we find that some beginning of scientific interest, if you will, in medicine emerged, and many of the old works in medicine were translated. Among the prominent translators was a man by the name of Ibn Muqaffa. In the 9th century, however, we witnessed a great deal of development in medicine, and perhaps the most prominent name in the 9th century is Fakhruddin al-Razi. In English, usually it's Razis, R-H-A-Z or S-E-S, Razis. He was the chief physician in the main hospital in Baghdad. And as historians describe him, is perhaps one of the greatest physicians of the whole of the so-called Middle Ages. He wrote a very voluminous encyclopedia, which was described by John Draper as an immense medical encyclopedia, which remained for about 600 years as one of the main and primary sources of knowledge about medicine in Europe. According to Draper also, he says that Razi's book on measles and smallpox was regarded also as one of the most authoritative writings in the field and remained in use in Europe for nearly 800 years after him, even, surprisingly, until the 18th century, more specifically in 1745, his book was still being translated and used as a basis for understanding these types of disease. The same person also, Al-Razi, was inspired by a saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, narrated in Bukhari and Muslim, in which the Prophet recommended the use of cold water to deal with persistent fevers. So he again used it quite effectively. He was able also to introduce the use of mild purgatives and cupping. In fact, according to another historian, the one that we quoted quite frequently in this last two programs, George Sarton, when he talks about the history of science, he says that many contributions, and they quote him, many contributions to gynecology, obstetrics, and ophthalmic surgery, eye surgery, can be traced back to him. In the 10th century, we find that these contributions continued also by other Muslim physicians. One of the famous names is Arib bin Sa'd, who was the first one to write in a systematic way on the subject of pediatrics, or children disease, in addition to contribution also to gynecology and obstetrics. Some of his works also were translated later into Hebrew and Latin. About the same period also, the 10th century, Al-Mardini was a famous physician who was particularly known for his ability in the preparation of medicines. About him, George Sarton says in his first volume, page 699, in the quote, that he compiled a dispensatory which was immensely popular in medieval Europe. For centuries, it remained the standard work on the subject.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, many historians mention the name of Avicenna. There's a legend in the history of medicine. I think that name may be a little bit distorted from his my tongue is twisted every day. It's Islamic origins, but Can you tell us a little bit about this this individual and how did he acquire this this fame?
Well, the Arabic name, as you indicated, is not exactly the adulterated English. The English term is Avicenna. Avicenna. In Arabic, it's Ibn Sina.
Yeah.
Ibn Sina is a legend, really, because he combined between being a scientist, philosopher, physician. I'm not evaluating him now as a philosopher. In fact, many Muslims may have some reservation about some of his philosophical ideas. But looking at his contribution as a scientist and a physician, it really helped us to understand the kind of atmosphere that existed in the glorious Muslim days, where scientific investigation was encouraged, where freedom of thought was very highly valued in society. Ibn Sina or Avicenna lived in the 11th century in the Christian era, and among his most important works in medicine is something called Qanun Fit-Tibb, in English, canon or precepts of medicine, composed of five volumes covering such subjects as physiology, hygiene, pathology, therapeutics. According to historians, particular historians of science like George Sarton, he says that for 600 years, this Qanun Fit-Tibb, or canon medicine by Ibn Sina, remained as the supreme authority in medicine. In fact, he mentioned that it was the basis of all medical studies in all French and Italian universities or faculties of medicine. In fact, it's really surprising to notice that some of the works of Avicenna in medicine were translated and used in European universities as late as the 18th century, and according to some historians, as late even as the early 19th century. That's more than, almost 800 years after his death. He also wrote a pharmacopoeia, which included 760 drugs and how they can be, prepared, which again reflected the excellence that Muslim scientists achieved in chemistry, which was possible to apply in pharmacology.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, when we think of the field of medicine, quite often our mind goes to the question of surgery. Mm-hmm. How about surgery? When did the Muslims get involved in this particular field?
Well, they got involved in surgery as early as the 11th century. In the 11th century, maybe before even, but in the 11th century, we get the historical accounts of their surgery to extract the cataract, this problem with the eyes. And they used to do that by extraction of the crystalline lens. They were also able to treat hemorrhage. They were particularly skillful in the use of cauterization. Among the famous surgeons in the entire Middle Ages, as they are called, is Abul Qasim bin Abbas. Again, in English, it's adulterated. Again, they call him Abul Qasis, who lived in Cordova, in Muslim Spain, under Muslim rule, towards the end of the 11th century and early 12th century. About Abul Qasim, or Abul Qasis, Sarton, in his first volume, says that he exerted a very deep influence upon the development of European surgery down to the Renaissance. That's in page 699. And another historian also who dealt with the subject, John Draper, whom we quoted before also, says that the surgical works by Abul Qasis continued to be used in Europe as late as 1497, so that's the very end of the 15th century. In addition to this, Abul Qasim also wrote a medical encyclopedia composed of 30 sections covering a wide variety of problems, but he was more particularly excellent in the surgical treatment of eyes, ears, and teeth. They didn't have that separation between dental and general medicine, as you see today. It is interesting to notice that in the writings of another philosopher, Ibn Rushd, or Averroes, as known in the West, in the 12th century. In his writing, Averroes gives illustrations of sections of the brains and eyes. He shows the eye nerves and an illustration of some of the surgical instruments used by Muslim surgeons. And we're talking about, again, 12th century.
Mm-hmm. So now, I think most of us have the impression that anesthetics, I believe it is, or rendering people unconscious is something that's relatively new in the field of medicine. Yet you're making mention of operations and surgery being performed in these very early times. What did the Muslim physicians use to render their patients unconscious in these early times?
Well, there's some pretty clear evidence that they were able to, because of course you can't go through some of these operations really without some form of anesthesia. According to John Draper, he said that Muslim physicians knew about anesthesia, and what they used was a kind of plant called the darnel, D-A-R-N-E-L, darnel. And they used to administer that in a gradual way until the patient becomes totally unconscious, and then they did the operation. So they knew something about it, too.
Mm-hmm. And now, are there any other notable contributions that we should touch on at this point before we examine another aspect, or move on to examination of another aspect of medicine?
Well, there are too many, really, to include in a short program like this. My best recommendation, really, would be to refer to the very excellent work done by George Sarton on the Introduction to the History of Sciences, where there are, you know, piles of names and contributions, but perhaps I can give you also a few more interesting contributions. For example, in Muslim Spain, or Spain under Muslim rule, one of the notable physicians was known, again, the original name is Ibn Zuhr. In the Latinized form, it's Ibn Zuhr. He was also the first one to write on bronchotomy. He was outstanding, particularly in the treatment of skin diseases, dermatology as we call it today, dislocations and fractures. In the 13th century, a famous Muslim physician by the name of Ibn Nafis lived in Syria, and he wrote a great deal about hygiene and diet, which some people regard as a relatively new field. It's not really. He wrote even about diet and health. And he demonstrated, and that perhaps was one of the amazing things, he demonstrated the circulatory system, and that was, you're talking about the 13th century, that is 300 years before the Portuguese physician by the name of Servet, S-E-R-V-E-T, Servent, was able to demonstrate. And many people think that it was that Portuguese physician who, you know, discovered it, but in fact, he did. In addition to this, we find that Muslim physicians showed some interest and competence also in psychopathology. They were successful in the treatment of psychological, or using psychological treatment for some of the patients, which is something many people would consider way ahead of their times.
Certainly. Well, now, medicine and hospitals, of course, always go together. When was the first hospital built by Muslims?
Well, when we deal with hospitals, maybe we should make a distinction between two types. There is the mobile hospital and then the permanent ones. If you take the first kind, the mobile hospitals, you can say that Muslims knew that as early as the 7th century, during the lifetime of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. For example, in the famous battle of the trench, or Al-Khandaq, when Muslims were in Medina and the pagans came to attack them, and the Prophet ordered a trench to be dug around the city to defend it. In preparation for the battle also, he ordered one big tent to be set for the explicit purpose of dealing with the casualties or, you know, treatment of the injured. During the peacetime, the concept of model hospitals was used quite effectively. In fact, if I may make a footnote here, many of the viewers in this area have been impressed by a recent TV program that showed a medical doctor who took his mobile home and started touring the remote areas where people have no access to doctors and staying for some time in every place, you know, to treat the patients. And many people regard that as a very admirable, which is, it is, a humanitarian gesture. But it's not really the product of the 20th century. In fact, Muslims have extensively used this mobile hospitals to look after the needs of people in rural areas. In fact, in the beginning of the first half of the 10th century, mm-hmm. so we talk about 1,000 years ago even, we find that there is historical narrative about ministers of the Jews during the time by the name of Isa bin Jarrah, who wrote a letter to the chief physician in Baghdad by the name of Sufyan bin Thabit, and he simply told him that there are so many people around in this rural areas who have no access to health care. Why don't you send us a kind of mobile hospital with some, you know, medicine and physicians alongside with it? And it is stated that there have been quite a few of these mobile hospitals touring different places. Historians describe them as well-equipped hospitals, even though they were carried on camels. That's the best we could provide, by, of course, yes. since we didn't have the mobile homes, of course, we have to do. But a hospital, or the mobile hospital, included everything from food, drugs, surgical instruments, as well as physicians also accompanied them and kept moving from one place to the other. In fact, one historian said that in the time of the Seljuk rulers, during Sultan Mahmud period, this mobile hospital became so big that one of them required as many as 40 camels to carry, you know, equipment, medicines, and other things that are needed. In addition to this, an interesting thing also that was found is that in many of the mosques, or some of the mosques, places of worship, they used to have even a pharmacy, a small pharmacy, so that during the day there is an attendant. So if you're passing by and you have some need for medicine, you can go and he can serve the medicine to you. And on Friday, which is the congregational prayer day, where lots of people come to the mosque, a doctor would come to the mosque, and after the prayer, he again examines any person who might need some medical attention, as was the case of the mosque of Ibn Tulun in Cairo.
Like the storefront clinics that we see in many of our
storefronts.
Yes, your first aid patients.
Right, right.
Well, your description of the mobile hospitals has been quite graphic. What about the permanent hospitals? Can you give some description of how these look?
Well, the permanent hospitals also did not take too long, really, to be known among Muslims. It is believed that the first one was built in Baghdad during the caliphate of Walid ibn Abd al-Malik. And we're really talking about the first half of the 8th century. And in describing the basic structure of Muslim hospitals, they used to have two wings, one for females and one for males. And then in every wing there are different halls. Each hall is assigned for one particular disease. And insofar as the hospital administration is concerned, each of these sections had a head physician, and then there is a physician in chief for the entire hospital or wing. Support staff was provided, including nurses, people who look after cleaning, food preparation. It was said also that many times the caliph himself would make surprise visits to make sure that people are treated humanely and looked after in the hospital. They had the system which we have today, exactly, of having a resident physician, you know, taking shifts and, you know, being available all the time there in the hospital just in case of any emergency. But another interesting thing is that the hospital also was viewed, as we view many hospitals today, and considers that a modern thing, which is not really. They used to regard the hospital also as a research institute. And historians say that in Muslim hospitals, after the doctors go around, you know, and finish visiting the patients, they would meet again in a big lecture hall where the chief physician and other, you know, famous physician would be seated, and the students, or medical students, as well as young physicians, sit down, and they start an open discussion as to what kind of cases they have seen, how did the person diagnose the disease, which was a very stimulating type of discussion. This kind of permanent hospitals was widespread in Muslim lands, and it is said that in Cordova, under Muslim Spain, again, Alone, there were as many as 50 hospitals. Remember, in one program in the past, you said that there were nearly 1 million inhabitants in Cordoba during the glory of its rule. It is mentioned also, and that's an interesting point also, that in many of these hospitals, there used to be a small farm attached to it where fresh vegetables and fruits is planted, rose trees, so that people can eat really fresh things direct from the hospital land. Some of them had artificial lakes, which shows that hospitals were not just viewed as some form of an institution to process people in and out, but as a very comfortable place in terms of furnishing and the aesthetic beauty also of it, and layout was quite interesting. Another thing that was mentioned about this hospital is that they used to get people to play humorous skits to cheer up the sick people. And Mustafa Sibai wrote once that he heard about a trust, special trust that was in Tripoli, in Syria, which is now in Lebanon, actually, in Greater Syria, I should say. And that trust supplied funds, or the funds were designated to hire two people, whose duty would be to go around and visit all hospitals around, and they talk to each other when they pass by patients' beds in such a way that deliberately make the patient hear them, oh, look at the sparkle in his eyes. Oh, look at the redness of his face. Say, oh, don't you see that he's really improved? Which is a really interesting trust and an interesting idea of the one who donated money for that trust, taking into account this psychological aspect of treatment. It's just fascinating to read about this type of hospital.
So we only have a few moments left in today's program, but I'd like to ask you about the questions of admission and the payment of hospital bills and so on. What can you tell us about the situation with respect to...
Well, information available on that shows that treatment was free for all in all of these hospitals. That included even strangers, travelers, passerby. You didn't have to have your MSI or Blue Cross or anything. It was all
Medicare.
All Medicare. Everything was available.
Years ago.
Right. A patient, usually, when he enters the hospital, usually is examined in an outside hall. If his case is simple, he's directed to the pharmacy where he can get some medicine and go home. Otherwise, he's admitted, and historians also say that even in this so-called Middle Ages, a person's name was recorded, then he goes through bathing first before he's admitted, and his clothing are taken and locked up, and he's given special hospital clothing, which are clean. Then he stays there, gets the medicine, medical care, food. People will look after washing his clothes also, his or her, of course, depending on the person. If a person starts getting over his disease, he's removed to another place, especially designated for convalescent patient. And some historians said that the evidence or sign that he is cured, that he'll be able to eat a whole loaf of bread and hot chicken, they knew that he was in good shape.
Yes.
When the person was discharged from the hospital, if he was poor, he used to be given new clothes, and in some cases even some amount of money, until he recovers and is able to earn his living again. If the person happens to die, then he's washed, and the coffin is made, and he's prepared for burial. Another interesting feature also is that for this, who preferred to have their treatment at home, they were allowed, and medicine was sent to them. And if they were poor, even food was sent to their own homes. In fact, one visitor came in the 12th century to the hospital in Baghdad and wanted to test the treatment and care. So he pretended to be sick. He was admitted. The doctor measured his, or tested his pulse. It was okay. And after some time, they let him stay there, giving him all kinds of food and fruits and everything. And then after 3 days, they wrote him a note that we host people only for 3 days, which is the Arab custom, 3 days is the maximum. So he understood that, they knew that he was not sick, but it was a clear indication of the kind of care and attention given to patients.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Personally, we don't have any more time left in today's program. We want to thank you for watching and invite you back next week when we continue our series. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Yeah.